Healthcare Access to order. I have a couple of announcements to make about bills I'm moving out of subcommittees to the full committee. I'm moving HB 2801. On that one, I made sure I had the votes to pass it, which I do, but we want to put it on tomorrow's agenda.
Friday.
I'm sorry, on Friday's agenda, so we don't have time to hear it in the access committee, because we didn't have it on today's agenda and still put it on Friday. So that's in this committee, and I'm pulling that. I'm also pulling HB 2946, which was we had the presentation in the access committee. This is an OHSU proposal to use some experimental IT stuff in some health clinics that want to do it, and it requires some ability to allow that to happen. It has basically no cost consequences, but again, we forgot to move it out. We heard that in the policy committee?
No, with access.
It was here also, okay.
Yeah.
We neglected to move it out, so I'm pulling it out, and they'll both be on the agenda for the full committee on Friday. You might want to refresh yourself on 2946. I suspect you all remember 2801 without much problem. Okay. That's not mine. All right. We're going to go with 3088. Is that right? First.
Sure.
Let's do it. You have the list. Why don't you? I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3088, and maybe you can refresh us on that bill.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Refresh us, if not you.
Sure, just summarize for you.
Thank you.
House Bill 3088 was submitted by the House Committee on Health Care, introduced at the committee's request. This bill prohibits hospitals from billing to or attempting to collect from uninsured patients charges that exceed either Medicare rates or rates paid by hospitals' highest volume commercial insurer. It allows patients to claim treble damages and attorney fees if the hospital bills or attempt to collect charges are in violation of this act. It requires the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research to establish standards for hospital cost efficiency and performance. It also requires the office to set total margins based on the standards, imposes annual charge for the hospital in the amount that earnings exceed allowable margins. It also establishes an excess revenue fund, continuously appropriates monies to the fund in the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research and the Department of Human Services. This takes effect the 91st day following adjournment of sine die. This has two subsequent referrals by prior reference, one to revenue first and then on to ways and means.
I'd like to hold this hearing to about 45 minutes, so I ask you all to please be as concise as you can. Tell us what you need to tell us, but mostly just tell us one time, and if you can find a way to use 5 words instead of 10, please do. We'll open with a panel of Alice Dale, Lynn Marie Kreider, and Mary Beth Healy, who favor the bill, and we'll follow that with a panel of Kevin Earls, Rick Kagan, and Priscilla Lewis to tell us why it's a horrible idea, and then we'll go on to whatever other witnesses we have, all of whom favor the bill, with the rest of the time available. So let's not filibuster. Ms. Dale? Ms. Kreider? Ms. Healy? Are we going to hear from that guy from Bend again, or is this a... I think he's been testifying before all the committees.
Rosebud.
No.
Ms. Bay, that'd be you.
Okay, all right.
Thank you, Chair Greenleck and members of the committee. I'm Alice Dale, the president of SEIU Local 49 and also the Northwest Area Director for SEIU International. Along with me on this piece of our testimony is Lynn Merck-Kreider, who is the Research and Public Policy Director for Local 49. So we'll, in the interest of time, try to go quickly through the handout you have. As you can see, the problems that are addressed by House Bill 3088 are that there are a large number of Oregonians without any health care coverage, and those costs are soaring, that many hospitals in Oregon are collecting record profits, and the hospitals bill the most to the people who are least able to pay. The solutions that are offered by House Bill 3088 do a couple of things, and they were just outlined, but let me quickly say. They put a lid on hospital profits, thereby, we believe, removing the incentive for hospitals to charge high prices. They allow hospitals that are very efficient and have higher patient outcomes to earn higher profits, again, creating an incentive to keep costs down and to improve quality. They use the excess profits to increase enrollment in Oregon Health Plan, and they lower what hospitals can charge the uninsured by linking it either to the rates charged to the highest volume insurer or what's paid by Medicare. So what is profit? As we define it, it is the revenue left over after paying all expenses. And so Lynn Marie is going to talk about a couple of these pages, and then I'll come back.
The profit can be expressed either as a percentage rate of profit or as a dollar amount of profit.
Lynn Marie, would you please identify
yourself? I'm sorry, Lynn Marie Kreider for SEIU. So we have the formulas here that are the standards for what is the rate of total profit and the dollar amount of total profit. The next page is a sample of an income and expense statement of a hospital system. And I think I'll point out a few things for you because it helps understand how profit works in the hospital industry. First of all, you have the operating revenues for this system at your left. And notice that's the total operating revenue, and then you have the operating expenses listed. And note that this hospital clarifies what's true in all profit calculations, that the operating expenses include the cost of charity care. You have a variety of other expenses. Those other expenses, operating expenses, include the cost of capital construction. You'll notice the line for a depreciation expense, which is the cost of capital construction that's done out of cash, and then the interest and amortization expense, which is the expense of debt for capital expenditures, right? So that's your expenses. And then you have a total operating expenses. And then you have the line which is excess of revenues over expenses from operations. And you'll see that we've noted that that's your operating profit number. And then you add, once you have your operating profit, you add your non-operating gains, and those would include things like investment income as the main major item, and it would also include donations would fall under that non-operating gain. And then you have a total excess of revenue over expenses, which is your total dollar amount of profit. The next slide notes that in 2003, hospitals in Maine agreed as part of the DIRIGO health plan effort to hold down healthcare spending in that state, agreed to cap, a voluntary cap on their operating profit of 3%. Now, what's happened actually is that the hospitals have not universally honored that commitment, and so there has been some debate in the state of Maine about whether there should be a mandatory cap, whether they should do something further, and I think nothing has happened at this point.
So Oregon would not be, if this bill passes, the first state in the country to limit what hospitals can charge the uninsured. Last year in California, they capped what hospitals can bill the uninsured to household incomes below 350% of the federal poverty level. And those charges are limited to what Medicare or Medicaid pays, whichever is greater. The next page shows you that more and more Oregonians don't have health insurance, and we know these, but the numbers here are pretty telling. You can see that from 96 at around 10%, we're now at 15% year 2006. So the problem is just worsening. Most Oregonians without health insurance, on the next page, are among the working poor. And you can see the statistics, the number of people who are employed, those who are at poverty-level incomes, and really very small percentage of people who have high incomes that are uninsured. Oregonians without insurance get charged more for hospital care. On the next slide, you can see that the list prices in Oregon hospitals average 207% of the hospital's cost. Insurance companies negotiate discounts off the list price, but uninsured patients who can't do that are usually charged the full list price. Then the next slide shows you really that the uninsured are billed a lot more than anyone else, and that's basically what that slide shows. You can see on the right it talks about private payers, Medicare, Medicaid, and then you can see the top line, which is the uninsured.
I'm sorry, was there a lawsuit among the major hospitals that I think you were involved in? Is that right there?
Miss
settlement still allow them to charge the full amount to people who...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we weren't actually involved in that lawsuit, but there was a lawsuit brought against Legacy and Providence, and the settlements established some discounting for low-income uninsured folks.
So the next slide, which is the pie chart, basically just shows you that Americans spend more for hospital care than any other component of personal health care spending, and it is 37%. Yeah, we hear a lot about prescription drugs. That's 12% of the pie. It is a problem. There's no question. On the other hand, if you think about the overall cost of healthcare spending, hospital spending is three times that. So it is a very significant issue that we're addressing before you today. The next slide shows that Oregon per capita spending on hospital care is growing more rapidly than the national average, and this has been the case now for many years. There is this sort of noticeable drop in 2003, and I want you just to want to note that this is not a reduction in per capita spending on health care. It was a reduction in the rate of increase during that time, and probably related to the high unemployment rate and the disenrollment in Oregon Health Plan during that time. On the next page,
are we higher in per capita expenditure for hospitals as well?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, no. In Oregon, our per capita hospital spending is lower than the national average, but as you see, the gap is shrinking.
Oh, how close is that gap?
Mr. Chairman, one of my colleagues did a projection which showed that by about 2020 we would be surpassing
how close
the
is
U.S.
That now?
I cannot give you the raw numbers. I'd be glad to get those for you.
Okay. On the next page, you can see that Oregon hospitals are among the most profitable in the nation. And again, get statistics from 1997 through 2004. And what we know is that the bill that we are supporting would save $121 million from the most profitable hospitals in Oregon. The next page talks about Oregon hospital profits in 2005. You can see that total profit earned by Oregon hospitals was $382 million. The total profit earned by the nonprofit hospitals was $365 million. And in Oregon, there are 57 hospitals. Two of those are for-profit. All the others are allegedly nonprofit, theoretically, technically. All right, but they earn a lot of money. So Oregon hospital profits.
Theoretically, technically. Are we talking about investor-owned versus non-investor-owned? Is that what the difference is?
We're talking about the Triad is a for-profit system. It has two hospitals in Oregon. All the others are nonprofit.
And is investor-owned. Is that right?
I don't know what it means.
That's another term that's sometimes used. Investor-owned. Is that
okay.
Is that what we mean?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Triad is a publicly traded for-profit.
Representative Miller?
Well, I think the term was, she said, technically, nonprofit hospitals I'm not quite sure. I think there was a mix or miscommunication.
No,
I don't think there is, actually.
I think there's two hospitals that are for-profit, and the rest of the state are not-for-profit.
And the difference is that the profit hospitals distribute profits to shareholders.
Correct.
And nonprofit hospitals hold the profits to use for whatever hospitals do.
Correct.
Mr. Chair,
it's
correct.
More than a technical difference.
Exactly. It's a huge difference. And then I have another question, if I may.
You may.
Thank you. This goes back, way back to your little financial statement, and so you're saying that net operating gains includes those gifts to hospitals?
That is part of total revenue, yes.
And so any philanthropy that hospitals do will be counted toward their total profit?
That's correct.
So I guess my question is, why would foundations within hospitals be, how are they going to entice people to give money to their organizations?
Yes. Interesting question, Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer. We find actually as a union that represents workers that frequently hospitals will ask workers to contribute to the hospital, which we find kind of astounding when those hospitals are making operating profits that are very high. I can't tell you how they entice them to do that.
Well, I believe they ask them. They say, would you like to contribute? And then they can either say yes or no. So I think the enticement is being part of the team. But anyway, thanks.
Thank you. So the next slide is a pie chart that shows Oregon hospital profits are highly variable. You can see that 52% have margins of more than 5%, 38% margins of 3% or less, and then 11% that are between the 3% and 5%. On the next page, you see that urban hospitals are the most profitable, and the type A and B are basically the rural hospitals. The DRGs are the urban hospitals. You can see the clear indication that urban hospitals are the most profitable in Oregon. The next page deals with multi-state systems, and you can see that they, as a category of hospitals, earn more profit in Oregon than one would anticipate they would based on the volume of their business in Oregon, which really means that Oregonians are disproportionately providing profit to these multi-state hospital systems. And you can see the chart below shows three systems, Providence Health and Services, Peace Health, and Triad, and the numbers there over the last couple of years. The next page shows that multi-state system hospitals are more profit than independent hospitals in Oregon. And again, you can see the percentage numbers here reflected in the chart. And then the last page is just summarizing that House Bill 3088 dedicates excess hospital profit to covering the uninsured. And if we had a total margin at a cap of 5%, it would have generated $121 million in 2005. And that $121 million could have been used to enroll over 52,000 adults under OHP standard. Alternatively, it would also cover the 117,000 children in Oregon who have no health care coverage today. So this packet of material concludes our formal presentation. We also have materials that we have provided to you that Lynn Marie drafted that deal with really highlighting the bill amendments. And then the third category is alternatives to addressing ways in which the excess hospital profits could be used to benefit Oregonians. And the question I had is, would you like us to take a couple of minutes to review that, or would you rather just review the written submission?
Representative Richards?
I'd like to have you clarify one thing. Essentially what we're saying is we're going to have 100% tax on hospitals above 5%, or whatever the number is, which would be a minimum of 5%. And the last slide says, if this had been in place before, we would have $121 million. What motivation would there be for hospitals to generate $121 million of profit if they know it's all going to go in the form of extra taxes? I mean, you and I wouldn't continue to work if we knew that we weren't going to keep any of it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, we hope what will happen is that there will be a moderation of pricing in hospitals, and so it would not generate, hopefully, $121 million in 1 year. That's what we hope would happen. But to the extent that hospitals do continue to charge more, then we think it's put to better use, since a lot of public dollars go to hospitals in this state, to expand health care benefits to people who don't have them today, rather than allowing the hospitals to hold on to that very high profit. We also believe that high profit does result in expenditures and that are not particularly useful in terms of holding costs down.
Thank you.
You know what the number is of the hospital tax during the same period? That would be offset if, I mean, the tax they've been voluntarily supporting. Is that $56
million? I don't know. Do you know?
Mr. Chair, are you referring to the provider tax?
I am referring to the provider tax.
I don't have it on the tip of my tongue. I'm sorry.
You might, but we would obviously assume they would not voluntarily continue the provider tax to support OHP if we passed this tax. Is that a safe assumption?
Mr. Chair, they have perhaps told you that, but the provider tax, of course, helps us to draw down federal funds, which are in turn used to increase reimbursement rates to hospitals. So
this would draw down the same.
That it would be cutting off their nose to spite their face.
Except this would draw down the federal funds.
This also would, to the extent, as Representative Richardson notes, to the extent that they actually choose to manage to produce a profit that we can use in this way. And we think it probably more likely that hospitals would choose to moderate their pricing in order to keep profits.
So we might use this to fight the tax under the assumption that this would produce the match that they needed, and then at the same time not produce this either. So, I mean, we might end up with fewer federal funds rather than with more federal funds if both scenarios happen, with both Representative Richardson's scenario and my scenario. I am sure if this passed, the hospitals would fight the provider tax. There's no question about that. And if they fight the provider tax, we can't pass the provider tax. So the provider tax goes away. This comes, and the response to this is to reduce profits. So we end up losing a significant amount of money going into an OHP match rather than increasing the money for an OHP match. Is that a wacky scenario? I've been accused of wacky ideas today, so.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I guess it is perhaps your job to assess those political realities. It does seem to us that the provider tax is in the interests of everyone in this state, and that I would expect that everyone would join hands to make that continue. And whether or not the hospitals choose to fight this bill.
Yeah. That'd be true if it didn't take 36 votes. Representative Cannon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very quickly, on this slide that is titled Aggregate Payment to Cost Ratios by Source of Revenue, does it purport to show this quite astonishing, I would say alarming, if I'm reading it accurately, fact that uninsured patients are paying, not just being billed, but are paying twice as much per service as, say, Medicaid patients?
Which chart are you looking at?
I don't think the pages are numbered, but it's sort of halfway, third of the way through the packet, maybe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, if I may, the lower three lines that show the payment to cost ratio for Medicaid, Medicare, and private payers are all what was actually collected, and those are published national statistics. The top line is actually a different source, and that is a line that we added to this graph, which is based on the cost-to-charge ratios shown in the Medicare cost report. So that would be the charge, the full list price. There are, as the chair noted, have been a couple of settlements where hospitals agreed to give discounts to at least some of their uninsured patients. There are uninsured patients who can't pay and their debts are not collected. So no, this is not what was actually collected. Some patients, to be sure, will scrape and borrow and do whatever it takes, go bankrupt if they have to try to pay that full price, but many do not end up paying that full price.
I appreciate your
the
candor.
Sticker price.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Mary Beth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Beth Healy. I'm Executive Director of Oregonians for Health Security. As you know, we're a statewide coalitional organization working to reduce the cost of health care and expand access to all Oregonians. And in the interest of time, I just want to point out a couple of things that I think would be very beneficial as we look at House Bill 3088 and why I think that this is a good piece of the overall health care crisis. We talk a lot, many of you, on this panel in the Reform Committee on Monday and Wednesday nights, but certainly in your work on this committee, about the escalating cost of health care. And when we think about the percentage costs of hospitals and the fact that there is such a discrepancy in the prices that Oregonians are charged based upon whether or not they are uninsured or whether or not they have insurance, whether it's public or private. And I think about this money in terms of what it would do to provide health insurance for those uninsured Oregonians. And when we don't have accountability and transparency in what is a pretty large component of our public health care dollars that get spent, but also certainly private dollars, it does seem to me that this is something to look at. And I just have to say that there are, you know, the unpaid medical bills are the number one cause of personal bankruptcy in this state. And one of those reasons is because of unpaid medical bills. When an uninsured individual goes to the hospital and they cannot make that payment, it is in very quick order that that bill is turned over to collections, and it makes it very difficult for individuals to pay those costs back. The Brown family that lives here in Salem had premature twins. Their hospital bill was over $600,000, and they had a difficult time trying to pay that back, and it was very difficult for them to do that. And I'm not saying that they weren't very grateful for the hospital care that they had, but were they charged twice as much as what those services would have already been? That's a question that they don't really know the answer to. We know that answer, but they don't. Barbara Ferguson of Roseburg was in an automobile accident 2 years ago, and she did not have health insurance. They had auto insurance. Both of the people in the accident had auto insurance, but Barbara did not have health insurance. And so she went to the urgent care, and she was concerned that she would have to pay cash. This is what they told her, that she would have to pay cash for the x-ray. She didn't have the money to pay for the x-ray, but she was worried that if she didn't have that x-ray, the auto insurance company wouldn't believe that she had actually been injured. So she had to pay the full price out of pocket for those tests. And she was shocked to learn that actually hospitals can do this. She did not know this. So this is another piece of the overall accountability and transparency that I think as we think about the reform efforts, that we need to address, because there's a lot, you know, we all hear that there's plenty of money in the healthcare system. This is part of that money. And we need to look at having it spent in a more effective and efficient manner and cover more Oregonians. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir. Go for it.
I'm sorry. This is not to Mary Beth, but I appreciate her testimony. But the question is back to that hospital provider tax. That's the question I was going to ask before. I don't see how you can have both in this. I think there's, you get one or the other.
Well, we'll be hearing from the hospitals in a moment.
I'm sure we will, but I'm just, to me, that this really, I'm not quite sure you get there. And then back to Representative Cann's question about this aggregate chart, I guess I have questions about what this means, that you're saying Medicaid pays hospitals at on this whatever 90% or 95% of how much it costs to provide the service?
Medicaid?
That's kind of, I'm asking if that is how...
It's actually more like 70% right now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, these are national... The bottom three lines, the Medicare, Medicaid, private payer lines, are national figures. I would venture to say that the number is lower in Oregon.
And I would venture to accept that venture, that it would be substantially lower than Oregon.
Let me give you an example. I was going to say that until the hospital folks came up. Why don't you start coming up? Who do we have? Kevin Earls, Rick Kagan, and Priscilla Lewis. I was in a hospital. I'll wait till he comes back.
Representative Greenlee.
I'm sorry, you're not done?
No, I just actually wanted to, and maybe someone else knows the answer to this, but as the, in terms of the provider tax, my understanding is that actually the hospitals get quite a bit of that money back.
As they will with this.
To cover, which they would. So I it would be great if somebody could do the math to see what that difference was. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, it does depend on the assumption of whether or not the hospitals will manage to the 5% as rather than a minimum, which they're managing now.
Thank you, sir.
5% is a cap. They manage that. If you've both eliminated the hospital tax and you've eliminated profits over 5%, then we're gonna all be in a bit of a problem on that. I was about to tell the story, and Kevin knows I was going to raise the story. I just spent 8 days in a hospital in Portland where I got 8 or 9 days where I got tremendous service and wonderful medical care, and I was very happy with it. I accidentally got in the middle of a bill because it was the thought that I owed some money, which I didn't know because my insurance company was going to pay it all. But the bill stated that the charges for my stay were $50,000. And it stated that it had been paid for that $10,000 and $40,000 were written off. So it was clear my insurance company had an arrangement with that hospital that they were paying essentially an 80% discount. At least it worked out that way on that bill. I know there were other charges. There are other things in that contract that make up some of that. But if I were a private pay patient, I would have been billed the $50,000. I also know from visiting the hospital, if I had come in with a checkbook and wanted to pay it, I would not have paid $50,000. I would have started the discussion at $35,000 and a 30% discount, and I could have probably bargained a significant amount off of that as well. But the number Representative Cannon was asking at, in this case, was the $50,000. It was that mythical charge that we have to figure out how to do away with because it just confuses the whole world. And the reason we had the community benefit bill before us and the reason we moved it out of here was because that bill, at the hospital's request, does not report those things in terms of charges anymore.
Right.
It reports them in terms of real costs, so we can start figuring out what the reality of the situation is. Kevin, if you guys would move quickly and thoroughly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we'd be pleased to do that.
Thank
For the
you.
Record, I'm Kevin Earls, representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I'm joined today by Rick Kagan and Priscilla Lewis from Providence Health System. We're going to divide our brief time before you today as follows. I have, in the interest of time, I'll probably bring up some exhibits during the course of our discussion for you to look at. But I'm going to try and address some of the high-level issues of why we feel House Bill 3088 does not make sense for Oregon. And there are really two issues in the bill, as I think you've identified. First is this concept of confiscation of margins and devoting it to an arguably very good cause. It's something that we're heavily invested in already. And then there's a second concept in the bill that deals with kind of the issue of billing and discounts and financial assistance for the uninsured. And I think those three things are the area where I would like to spend most of my few minutes discussing. So I'll kind of try and give you the high points. Mr. Kagan and Ms. Lewis are going to talk about kind of the reality from within a hospital system. And one of the issues that we wanted to get on the table today is the chair's correct identification of this mythical and troublesome issue about bill charges. And Mr. Kagan will address that in his comments, but it is an area where we completely agree that there's a lot of confusion. We would prefer not to have to work from that concept. It's required under federal law, and Mr. Kagan will address that. So briefly, as to the margins piece, I think the thing that the committee needs to hear most is that margins in our industry are highly variable. You heard Ms. Dale make that comment in her testimony. They are. And it isn't that some hospitals are always solid and some hospitals are not. There's high variability from year to year with any given hospital. There are better performers and less better performers or over time, but there is a high degree of variability from year to year and over the period of a decade. Margins need to average about 5% in order to be able to access the bond markets and keep borrowing costs low, something that we think is a critical part of keeping health care costs low in this state. And in any given year, dozens of hospitals in Oregon have negative margins. Not just they may not hit 5%, but they may have margins that are less than 1% or negative. Nationally, I do need glasses. Nationally, we're in the middle. In terms of margins relative to other states, Oregon ranks 25th in margins on an average operating margin. So that's kind of that's the revenue associated with actual patient care. We rank 27th out of all states with a 3.5%. This is 2005 data. 27th out of all states on total margins. So the bill has problems in this regard because it doesn't anticipate these kind of fluctuations or the expectations of capital markets for the industry and specific hospitals and systems to maintain a ongoing level, ongoing margin. As to the second part of the bill, with regard to billing, discounts, and financial assistance, one of the things that has not been addressed in the testimony so far is that Oregon has been a national leader in developing model hospital financial assistance programs. It's something that we did in the late 90s with the Oregon Health Action Campaign and other stakeholders in the Portland area. We developed a model set of guidelines from which hospitals developed their own financial assistance policies. That later became adopted statewide by our association and all of its members. And right now, today, you have every hospital in the state has a very substantial financial assistance policy in place to meet the needs of uninsured people in its community. The issue is that every hospital and every community has a different set of circumstances. And so trying to pick a one-size-fits-all solution is very problematic. You really need to be able to balance the resources of a given hospital with the demands, the unmet medical needs of the community. And so we think that it's important that the committee consider that there needs to be flexibility and that a voluntary system such as Oregon has developed is the appropriate way to go. Finally, we think that not all uninsured people are uninsured by accident or by circumstance. Some are by choice. And we have data that's available on the Office of Health Policy's website that shows a significant percentage of Oregon's uninsured have income levels that are 300 or 500% or more of the federal poverty level. They have income levels that would allow them to buy health insurance, but they're making a decision. And we don't think that it is necessarily an appropriate way to expend hospital resources to subsidize those kinds of decisions. Finally, I would tell you that with the advent of health savings accounts and medical savings accounts, there is a growing concern about whether or not people can meet their obligations for hospital services under those policies. If there is a discount that is implemented statewide, we feel that it really raises the question for people, you know, I'm struggling with health insurance anyway. Why should I maintain hospital coverage if I can get a substantial discount without having to have insurance? So we think that there's a concern about undermining the basic group and individual health insurance plan design in the market. With that, I'll close. I'm going to try and bring up some data during this discussion, but I'll defer the rest of the time to the province representatives.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mr. Earle said that I was going to...
Introduce yourself, please.
Oh, thank you. Rick Kagan. My name is Rick Kagan. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer for the Providence Health System in Oregon. Happy to be here. Thanks for the opportunity. Again, Mr. Earls mentioned that I was at Priscilla and I, Ms. Lewis and I, were going to get to the hospital specific. But before I do, I would like you to indulge me, if you would, with just a very quick story, a little high-level story. When I was born a little over 55 years ago, the percentage of the gross national product, gross domestic product, attributable to health care, Mr. Chair, you will know this because of your history, was 4%.
I was going to say
4%. 25 years later, when my son David was born, you're calculating, 25 years later when my son David was born, it had doubled to 8%. 25 years later, when my granddaughter Stella was born, it had doubled again. Now, I won't take off my shoes to show you 16%, but it had doubled again to 16%. In my opinion, that is unacceptable. That we can't sustain that sort of increase. As you know, Mr. Chair and committee members, we have a number of reform programs and packages before this legislature, before the federal legislature. It is imperative in our opinion and in my personal opinion that we be thoughtful about comprehensive reform rather than try to fix what we have agreed is an illogical reimbursement system. We at the Providence Health System believe that healthcare reform, so that we can provide care to the 600,000 Oregonians, is imperative, and that universal access, universal coverage is imperative. And hopefully there are hearings tonight and for the rest of your session relative to health care reform, and in our opinion that's the move that we need to make. As Mr. Earle says, there are a number of problematic parts of this bill. The first is the margin cap. He articulated very well the issues. We believe that a margin cap would do two things at least: raise the cost of health care, number one, and potentially delay the provision of needed services by placing unwise and untested limits on margins. Again, the raising of the cost of health care would primarily be due to rating agencies downgrading our ratings for our bond issues, thus forcing us to pay larger interest rates just like we do for homes and other things, which would raise our annual expense for health care. The effect, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the effect of the excess revenue fund as described in the bill will destabilize the hospitals in Oregon. There's been testimony today, and Mr. Earls mentioned the fact that we do make a margin. We make a margin to be able to provide high-quality care and to be able to provide charity care to those that need charity care. But one of the things that all hospitals do, their margins ebb and flow. There are times when, in the Providence Health System, the larger hospitals support with a little higher margins our smaller rural hospitals that do poorly from a margin standpoint. Those hospitals still need to improve service, they still need to improve quality, they still need to build facilities to be able to serve their communities. There are times when the larger hospitals fund those efforts. The second issue that Mr. Earls raised, an issue that is critical, is the issue of the uninsured patient and how we bill the uninsured patient. We've taken a very, very close look at the uninsured patient and our discount and financial assistance policy, and I will ask in just a minute my colleague, Priscilla, to go through an example that you have in your packet relative to the uninsured patient. But we've seen an increase in the uninsured patients and have been diligent in our financial assistance policy to deal with those folks and help them through the process. We understand very, very clearly, as I mentioned early on, we understand very clearly the issues for all of those purchasing health insurance and getting health care. Rising costs, increased limits to access because of limits to physician availability and others, and insurance with limited coverage or very high premiums. We understand that and have developed a financial assistance policy to address that. I can with confidence say that our uninsured patients never see a full price bill and never pay a full price bill for service, as you, Mr. Chair, have articulated.
I need to move along.
Yes, sir. I'll turn the time to Ms. Lewis. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. Actually, what I'd like to do is present...
Please identify yourself.
Oh, I'm Priscilla Lewis with Providence Health System. I was hoping to present you an opportunity to ask me any questions about the table that is with the document that you received. And I wanted to try and walk you through a little bit about what happens to an uninsured patient that comes to Providence Health System. At Providence, we initiated an uninsured discount in 2004, in the final quarter of 2004. And so we have the longest experience with an uninsured discount, a voluntary uninsured discount of any health system in the state. And first of 2006, the uninsured discount was applied to all uninsured bills. Prior to that, any patient requesting the uninsured discount was given the uninsured discount. So this is not a concept that is foreign to us, nor is it a concept that we did not see the need for. But I guess what I'd like to stress is that we recognize that this is not the answer to providing adequate access to the uninsured. What we can do for the uninsured is, after they have presented our emergency room, we can assist them with their bill. But the bigger answer is in universal reform that keeps them from having to come to the emergency room because they have no other access for care. And the uninsured discount, although we think it's the right thing to do in our current environment, it's another piecemeal solution that just further makes our whole payment system a little bit crazier and much more of a patchwork quilt. We are committed to the uninsured discount until health care reform is in place. We have it in place now, and we do not foresee taking it away. But I think that's part of the reason we feel like we can speak to this issue as not being a larger solution and not appropriate, we believe, for legislation. It's important to think about what we incent in terms of our public policy also. So with that, I'll turn it over if you have any questions about this particular table. And basically what I asked my billing team to do was to find a common procedure and an actual patient, although we started with one actual patient that had a fairly complex appendectomy. It was a 4 to 5 day stay. So they took the rounded charges and then worked that patient's bill through a number of payers to show you both the impact of the uninsured discount for that uninsured patient if they were making 300% of federal poverty level or if they were at 200% of federal poverty level, and also to show you the impact of charity care, which kicks in at 200% of federal poverty level. A qualifying patient would pay no charges if they're earning 200% or less of federal poverty level. So do you have any questions?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Earls referenced something that was going to be covered, and that was the federal laws that require you to charge so much.
Yes, thank you, Representative, Mr. Chair.
Charge so much, bill so much.
No, they can charge it. They can write off charges.
Yeah,
okay, you're right. That's right.
Medicare does require, the simple answer to the question, Medicare does require uniform pricing structure. They require that we have a uniform build charge.
Okay, but that doesn't answer the question why you have a build charge that is like $4,000, $5,000 higher than your highest payer. Or $7,000. Sorry. So why is there a delta between that, between your highest contracted rate and your actual bill?
Our highest contracted.
Okay, I'm sorry. But why would it, because I'm assuming your highest contracted rate is not $19,800.
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, I think for the purposes of this discussion, it's best to kind of pan out a bit and look at it from a higher altitude.
And then very quickly.
In effect, it's somewhat analogous to a phenomenon that most of us are more familiar with, which is the rack rate in a hotel. You have to have a uniform rate. You know, it's the one that's posted on the back of the door. You look at it and say, geez, I didn't pay that. And you're thankful. And, you know, it's a little like that,
worst,
frankly.
You say, oh, I am paying that.
Exactly.
Yes,
exactly.
True. So there is a fiction, as the chair has implied, about that big number. Because, in effect, virtually no one pays that. And so, in conclusion, I think the thing that we want to leave you with is, first of all, that people who live in poverty and need hospital services, get them. And typically, they're written off. It's not that they're discounted from charges. They don't pay. So the charge is an irrelevant fiction in this case. If for virtually every hospital in the state, if somebody's living in poverty, they end up with no bill. If they're living at ranges well above 100% of the federal poverty level, they would get discounts significantly beyond what this bill represents. Beyond that, as this data from the Office of Health Policy represents, this is 2004 data. It's the most current they have available. But you look at the areas that are blued on the graph, and you'll notice that in column F, the bottom three blue categories are for levels 2004 poverty level for a family of four with incomes up to $75,000. There were about almost 50,000 people living in that area, in that income range. 400 to 500%, so incomes up to $94,000.
Kevin?
There were 44,000. So there's 130,000 people living at incomes that most of us would say aren't really poverty, but this legislation would extend to them.
Just go on. Okay, thank you very much. Hang around a bit. I'm going to take about 10 minutes more than I thought. And okay, and I'm going to ask Beth Ann, Darby, Matt Fries, and Art Lee. And I'll give you 10 minutes total. While they come up, let me tell you where I think I want to go with this bill. There are obviously two separate parts
I'm going to schedule this bill again for a hearing in the subcommittee next Wednesday, a week from today, because of time schedules, and we'll want to possibly schedule it in the full committee a week from Friday. I'd very much like the two sides on this, the SEIU and the Association of Hospitals, to get together and see whether you can't come up with any kind of an amendment that you can both agree on one or both of the parts of the bill. It would be very useful. But what I definitely will want, and I'll ask Sandy to facilitate it, I want amendments that will, at the very least, split the bill into two parts. But it would be, so we can consider them in the committee, but it would be very useful if there's some way to come to some joint agreement on this, or at least to get close to a joint agreement. It would be very helpful. All right, any order you want. Let's see. Age before beauty or beauty first?
Beauty first. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matthew Fries. I'm a certified nurse's assistant and a telemetry analyst at Providence St. Vincent Medical Center. I live at 16265 Southwest D-Lane Court in Beaverton, Oregon, and I'm appearing in support of House Bill 3088. My coworkers and I are, with the help of SEIU Local 49, trying to organize a union in order to gain a voice on the job to better address issues in the hospital, such as better patient care, better staffing, and better training. I support House Bill 3088 because I feel as if many Oregon hospitals currently are operating without always keeping the patient's or staff's best interests in mind. Although many hospitals are making large profits, St. Vincent's made $64 million in 2005 in profit. They are not always reinvesting that money where it's most needed, at the bedside. Specifically at St. Vincent's, we are continually being told that we cannot afford to adequately staff our patient care floors with enough nursing, housekeeping, and other support staff due to the budget. I work on the sixth floor at St. Vincent's, which is a cardiac telemetry floor. As a telemetry analyst, I normally monitor the heart rhythms of 30 to 40 patients, but there have been shifts where I've been expected to watch all the patients on the floor, which could number as high as 70 patients. In my opinion, these are unsafe practices, and I worry that it endangers our patients. I hope hospital administration will listen to our pleas about better staffing so that nothing seriously happens as a result of short staffing. Short staffing can also be a risk to the staff. Many of our patients are quite heavy, and without proper help to move them, several of my coworkers have been injured. I myself have sustained numerous back muscle pulls and have even had a partially torn rotator cuff from all the work done at St. Vincent's. I believe that if we had more staff, we could team lift, many injuries might be avoided. It's frustrating watching the profits of hospitals continue to expand while the services that they should provide to the community continue to disappear. Providence St. Vincent Medical Center in 2005 had a profit margin of almost 11%.
That's right.
And it's considered a non-profit hospital.
20 minutes.
That's not... Oregon is the second most expensive state to spend a day in the hospital, and that's not something that I can be proud of. With your support of House Bill 3088, that can change. The passing of this legislation would require hospitals to spend money where it would best benefit the community. Better staffing, better equipment, and a better budget for the Oregon Health Plan. Thank you for allowing me to share my testimony.
Thank you. I do need to acknowledge for the record three sets of written testimony I've received from one from Maeve Carroll of Providence St. Vincent's, one from Annette Olibecker of Providence Portland Medical Center, and one from Trish Smith from the Oregon School Employees Association, all in support of the bill.
Chairman Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Art Lee. I'm an emergency room technician at Samaritan Pacific Communities Hospital in Newport, Oregon. I've worked there for over 10 years, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3088. Working in the emergency room, you see many different types of people come through, and there has been an increase in the uninsured patients. I know that more and more people are struggling to be able to afford their health insurance, including my coworkers and other people who live on the coast. Every dollar that we put into the health care system is a precious resource that we should use wisely and judiciously in the public interest. House Bill 3088 at least gives some guarantee to people that there is a limit, a ceiling to what we are allowed to be charged. However, that only addresses the cost of hospitals for the uninsured. The rest of House Bill 3088 encourages hospitals to lower the prices or to reinvest in the hospital system that serves the community, reducing health care costs and improving services for everyone. Community hospitals like mine provide a vital service of health care. And as a healthcare worker who witnesses every day the investment or disinvestment of the healthcare system on the insured and the uninsured, I hope that all of you will consider House Bill 3088 as a serious solution to the healthcare crisis. Thank you
very much. Beth Ann?
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Beth Ann Darby, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Education Association, our 46,000 members. As you well know, skyrocketing health care costs affect all Oregon families and businesses and drain precious resources away from schools and community colleges. For this reason, earlier in the session, OEA supported Senate Bill 426, which created a health insurance savings pool for educators. We know that this is just that was just one of the many tools necessary to engage in real health care reform. We know that medical inflation is taking its toll on everyone and is projected to continue into the future with double-digit increases unless we change how we purchase health care. We think that measures that support transparency and accountability make good sense. Hospital pricing is just an important piece of this puzzle, and that's why we support House Bill 3088.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I also need to read into the record testimony from Betty Haas, the WRC board member. I want to thank all of you that have come to testify and won't have a chance. Perhaps we'll have a chance. We'll see how things go next week. I also want to thank you, Ms. Dale, for bringing this bill. It is an important bill for us to be considering, and I think it's important for all of you, so I think this was a useful session. I hope we can make a little progress in getting something next week that we may be able to all agree upon, but if not, we'll move ahead and consider what's in front of us. I will close the public hearing on 3088 and open a public hearing. What we're going to do now is we're going to look at two bills, 3341, that's been proposed by Representative Richardson, and 3368, that has my name on it as a proposal, but in fact what it is our attempt to create a legislative proposal from the Oregon Health Policy Commission's report on health care reform. And I've asked Terry Barnett, who is the chair of the Oregon Health Policy Commission, and Gretchen, to be with them to report on that bill. What I ask you to do is each, if you'll take about 20 minutes or maybe a little more to talk about that. Representative Richardson, perhaps you could start. And then you, Carrie, and I hope we'll have a chance to have a little discussion as well. And perhaps you can come back or you can hang out there when you're done, whatever is your preference.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, hold on. Ooh, sorry. Sandy keeps me on the ball. I need to open a public hearing on House Bill 3341 and a public hearing on House Bill 3368. We'll hear them together.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dennis Richardson, and although I'm the state representative for Southern Oregon between Medford and Grants Pass, I'm coming before this committee today as a sponsor of House Bill 3341 and as an interested ex-health insurance agent and administrator from 1974 and 75, a long time ago. But back then, life was a lot different in healthcare. An average policy, a very nice policy for a family, cost between $21 and $25 a month, and the benefits were extremely good. But things were much different in the way that they were handled. I'm just a small town attorney. I'm not a healthcare expert. But I've noticed in the studying that we've done in the legislature and just in as a citizen, that there are three areas that really have affected the increase in costs. One is the technology that's come. I remember reading and seeing a presentation by OHSU economist Bill McConnell, in which he said one of the...
John McConnell.
One of the reasons that there's additional costs is because of technology. He said in 1950, if you had a heart attack, you died. And that today, if you're maybe a 50-year-old person, you have a heart attack and you spend $40,000, you live. And so just the advances that we've made in medicine and the technology have cost a lot and cost a lot to implement, but they also save a lot of lives. The second is pharmaceutical drugs. There are miracle drugs out there that have solved tremendous problems in healthcare, but they also they're highly effective and also highly expensive. But the third that I'd like to focus on initially is the transformation from health insurance to prepaid medical health care. Back in the 70s, you had car insurance, health insurance, auto insurance, and they all were like insurance policies. I mean, when you have health insurance back then, you had deductibles, you had to be responsible for front-end payment, and then you had insurance that would help take care of the catastrophic loss with copays, and then a stop loss and a payment when it was too large for people to actually be able to afford. That's not the same today. You know, if you have homeowners insurance, you pay a premium and you have true insurance for catastrophic loss. You don't file a claim because your roof needs to be replaced. If you need new carpeting, you don't file a claim to get new carpeting. Or if your walls need to be painted, you don't file a claim. If you did, the cost of homeowners insurance would skyrocket. Same thing with the car. You don't get your insurance to pay for an oil change or for new tires. You have car insurance to protect you from catastrophic losses that could occur from utilizing a vehicle. And yet, in health insurance, we've made this huge shift to where now we have this paradox where one of the reasons that we have such an expensive amount of health care in Oregon is in Oregon and America, is because it has become so cheap for us to use as individuals. I was reading recently that out of a dollar worth of health care, the actual person pays about 14 cents. And so the remainder is paid by insurance companies or write-offs or government benefits or programs, but only 14 cents out of a dollar actually comes from our pocket. And so if you've got a situation where you're paying $600 or $700 or $900 a month for a premium, then and you get sick a little bit, if you're going to pay a $5 or $10 copay, you go to the doctor. If you go to the doctor and you have a drug benefit, and you're going to get a prescription, and you're going to pay $10 copay for that prescription, whether it's a $150 brand drug or a $20 generic, you take the one that you saw on TV. I mean, why not? You have no stake in what is actually being paid, except you're going to pay the same copay. And so we have this situation where we've shifted from true insurance to a prepaid medical system, and it increases utilization, and it is one of the main drivers in why things are so expensive. And so now, in this legislature, we're confronted with this opportunity to consider what we can do to reform healthcare. Well, that's kind of a global idea of reforming healthcare, and will take years to implement. It's a long-term focus, but we also should be looking at what can we actually do? I mean, what achievable goals can we have that we could pass and affect as a legislature now that would help lessen the costs and the skyrocketing increases that continue at three times the rate of normal inflation? And what can we do to increase access for health care to citizens that currently don't have it? Now, when we're talking about access, we need to remember we're not talking about insurance. Health access is different than health insurance coverage. I mean, one of the anomalies of the Healthy Kids plan that's being proposed is we need to cover with insurance coverage benefits 117,000 uninsured children. But what's not often remembered is that over 60,000 of them currently qualify for coverage today. I mean, they're under 185% of poverty level, and so they could have the insurance coverage if they just would sign up, or their parents would help them sign up, but they're uninsured. And so here we are about to have this expensive and new program, in a lot of ways new, so that we can provide coverage when you have more than half of the kids already qualifying for the coverage but just don't have it. And why I think it's a mistake is that we're focusing on coverage and not focusing also on access. And so here we have a system where we need to focus on, as we look at what is doable, what are achievable goals. One is, how can we utilize systems that are currently in place, whether it's FQHCs, Federal Qualified Health Centers, or other safety net clinics, or public clinics on a county level, or school-based clinics, by utilizing facilities and just changing the way that we're utilizing them in a way, since in many small towns, the school is like the center of the community. And so there are facilities out there that if we would just work together and look at ways that we could utilize them for a fraction of the cost of a reformation of the whole system, we can actually increase access. Now, several concerned legislators and other health insurance experts and advocates are working on this very issue of increasing the utilization of current facilities. So we can do something to help increase access without just focusing on more coverage. Next is, how do we rein in skyrocketing health costs? We need to have health care that is sustainable. We've got to stop this unbridled escalation of health care costs. And so any plan that we look at, we should consider, one is the mandates that we impose as government. So often what government intends to do to help ends up hurting people. Whenever we install additional mandates, it affects the number of people that are insured adversely. The more mandates, the less people are insured, according to a Yale University study that was dealing with that very topic. We could also lessen state regulation over personal health insurance. Private health insurance is not free market health insurance. In many ways, the government has essentially used or co-opted private insurance companies to become their surrogates or their administrators of benefits. When you regulate, when you mandate, then you actually continue to lessen the flexibility of a private insurance company to be competitive because they have so many things that they have to do to meet with the regulation. Next, we also could allow insurance company or insurance coverage to be national. Why should it have to? Why should we be limited only to buy insurance from states, from carriers that are just in Oregon? If there's a great Idaho carrier, why not be able to buy insurance from them? Certainly, there needs to be some regulation to assure that companies are bona fide. But like life insurance policies, when you move around, you don't necessarily have to cancel your life insurance and buy a new policy in another state. And so if we would open the market up some, we'd have greater competition, and we could help rein in these escalating costs. We also need to seriously look at this antiquated employer-based insurance system that we have. We know that it came as kind of a post-World War II response to wage controls. But we have a situation now where we're punishing people that are either self-employed or unemployed because they can't get tax deductibility unless they happen to be employed with an employer who provides group health insurance. And so we need, if we're going to help do something that is can be done today, to look at what can be done to help provide tax deductibility to individuals, to promote individual purchase of policies so that there can be more portability. And if they leave employment, which is certainly much more frequent now than it was a few decades ago, they don't have to worry so much about what are they going to do about health coverage. Even just going from one job to the next, often there's 30 or 60 or 90 day waiting periods, and those kinds of waiting periods can put people at risk. So if we were to have a program and make some changes so that individual policies were also tax deductible, then we could start shifting from this anomaly, this employer-based system, which is archaic and is no longer applicable in the kind of market and the kind of transition and mobility that we have among workers in the marketplace today. So if we do those things, we could have a program or some changes made that can help deal with both access and costs. House Bill 3341 is a work-in-process healthcare draft bill to advance the discussion on how to achieve these above goals. It has several provisions. One is that it provides a base policy or a base set of benefits that are available that are controlled by the individual. These can be utilized both for the needy and for the self-sufficient. For the needy, they can have primary care from the clinics that we previously discussed that are in place today. We need to assure that the state would make payment for those kinds of care. We also have MCOs that are in place today, and so we can help assure that those that are most needy can have the primary care on the front end that they're going to need without having to come out of money out of their pocket, except that we could make it means-based so that as people are, you know, more self-reliant or having greater income can more afford to pay their a portion of their health care until they're fully self-sufficient. As far as those that are working or have assets and are self-sufficient, we can provide for them health benefit accounts, which is the term that is used in this bill, but they're similar to health savings accounts. These are tax deductible, according to the bill, up to $2,000, and the idea being that if we have individuals be able to contribute into their own managed account certain amounts of money, and they could be deductible up to $2,000, yet why not allow it to be more than that if they want to, if they want to contribute more to it, then that money will be placed in an account for them. They'll have a card, an Oregon health card, and that card will be like a debit card, so that when they go to get health care, we're talking about primary care, they can go to a doctor's office and swipe the card and pay at the point of service, which saves the medical providers a tremendous amount of money because, as been said by Representative Maurer and others in the community, quite often providers, or generally, they will provide a service, submit a bill, and wait 1 to 6 months to get paid, and they don't know how much they're going to get paid. They don't know what the reimbursement rate's going to be because different carriers provide different amounts, and so it's very difficult to be able to plan your budget when you don't even know what you're going to get paid. But if you knew that when a person came in, that you could go on the internet, they give you their PIN number, you can go to the website that would be created part of this bill. As part of this bill, it's an insurance policy access center, and find out how much is in the account, or you can say the cost for this procedure or this visit is $46, and it plugs in and they say yes, there's enough money to cover a $46 visit, and so you get approval from the client through their a password that where they would give their approval, and then that account, or it could even be done off of the card itself, and that their account, their health savings account or health benefit account, whichever it's called, would automatically be deducted by that amount of money. And so now you've got an individual who's got tax deductibility to put money into his account. He's going to pay at point of service, and so he's going to be somewhat concerned about how much he's going to be spending. All of a sudden, when it comes to buying a prescription, it won't be, well, I think I'll just get the $150 drug. There'll be questions asked. Well, you know, what if I get this prescription, is there one that won't cost me as much? Because with the health savings account, they would be able to have money accumulate, be rolled over after it reaches a level that could be, you know, put together as part of a well-considered plan. If they get more than that, the money could even be used for other things. Why not have excess amounts in those accounts be able to be utilized for long-term care policy premiums? We know we're going to need that, and we know that that's something that faces us in the future. And so why not promote people using their money wisely that are in their health accounts so that it will accumulate so they can utilize it in other ways? What if they want to go to an alternative form of health care? If they have it in their account, why should they not be allowed to do that? Maybe it's an acupuncturist, or maybe it's another one. If they're licensed to provide a medical service or health service, then why shouldn't they be able to utilize their own money from their HSA for those kinds of services? It gives a patient a stake in the outcome and some control over how they get their health care. Now, to make all this happen, we would provide an Oregon Health Insurance Exchange. Now, the exchange would be given the assignment to ease public access to high-deductible health insurance policies, to coordinate and promote health benefits, because we're going to have high-deductible policies proposed here. so that you can handle your front-end benefits with your card and your HSA or your managed care if you happen to be in that population that wouldn't use an HSA. But after that limit, then have a high deductible insurance policy. And the insurance policy will be one that's bid on. I mean, different carriers would be able to provide much more competitive prices because they're not having to spend so much in administering these front-end benefits, which takes so much time, so much cost, and that cost gets transferred right on to the system and to the individual. So if we have the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange, they create the Insurance Policy Access Center, which is a web-based source of information where you can go and compare policies. You can coordinate and promote the idea of preventive care. You can get information. There can be health directives for plans to make it simple for people to plan for last or late life care decisions. It can coordinate the primary care access for the poor with FQHCs, the other primary care access points of service, and give assistance with purchasing high deductible insurance policies for the catastrophic needs of the poor. Why should we, as the state of Oregon, have to have one of the if not the largest, one of the largest health care insurance companies in the state? Why does the state of Oregon need to be a health insurance company? Why does it have to provide everything when we have markets out there that could provide benefits that are high deductible so that it's catastrophic care and not have to have those kinds of burdens borne by the government when we have free enterprise and competitive marketplaces that would help keep the prices down if we would open that up? So I've mentioned that we would have a low-end, front-end set of benefits through either HSA or provided for the needy, utilizing current access points and NCOs. I mentioned the Oregon Health accounts, the Oregon Health Card, which is like a debit card point of service use, which would help control costs. The Oregon Health Insurance Exchange would also have as a piece of it transparency of costs so that people that want to know what it's going to cost them to have various types of care from different providers could go and find out before they expend the expense what the costs are going to be. And the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange also would create the Insurance Policy Access Center, which would be this web-based access to get this kind of information. When you put it all together, what we're trying to do is find a creative way to deal with a situation today that is unsustainable. It's not enough merely to say we want to have a global reformation where we're going to have a board which will be politicized from day one that will ultimately try to go to the federal government and get regulations passed when they won't want to pass them, try and get more money from the federal government when they don't want to pay it, and it'll set a bad precedent for them to give more money for Oregon when the other states that are in the bottom half of the average would like to have more money. That's unlikely to do anything that would set that kind of precedent, and a system that will have a huge price tag funded by additional taxes, which are inevitably going to cause pushback from providers who have as an incentive keeping the money coming in and not taking less money just because it would be nice for the system. So you have that inherent pushback from 51% of the anti-tax increase voters, the anti-tax lobby, and healthcare providers that will consolidate to try and stop anything that's going to shift to a government model, government-controlled insurance or government-controlled healthcare system that's going to take years to implement if it can't be implemented. So my recommendation is that we look at what we can do to increase access and to start reining in the costs, and by using HSAs, health card, a net-based access, and an exchange that the state could utilize and create to help give information and transparency and make it a simpler system, that these all are encompassed in House Bill 3341, and I would hope that we could give consideration to it. Thank you.
Very nice, Mr. Vice Chair.
Go ahead, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I've got a couple questions about the plans offered through the exchange. So a plan cannot exclude anybody.
The plan would not exclude anyone. In fact, it would be set up with a unique way to handle pre-existing conditions. One of the problems with health insurance companies is that they factor into their costs the possibility that they will get some really bad risks. And so we could set this up so that the Oregon Medical
Oregon Medical Insurance
Pool could cover or reimburse maybe 80% of the cost of pre-existing conditions, and that would be defined as care treatment received within 6 months of the application for the insurance. And by doing it, those costs would be shared over all the health providers and would allow the insurers to have lower costs, underwriting costs, because they don't have to worry about getting hit with unexpected huge health losses.
Follow up. And then the other major issue is that these plans would be excluded from other insurance mandates that we have in the state of Oregon.
I believe it's going to be necessary for us to do that. Sooner or later, we have to face the fact that we've got 31 mandates. We're going for 32, 40, 33 maybe. We're not done yet.
We're not done.
These mandates all have a cost. And while we as a state say, you know what, we need to help folks because they're unable to help themselves, and we put them in, there is a cost for those things. And so we need to promote preventative care, chronic care, and lifestyle change, all of those things, but they need to be done through incentives and through education and training, but not just by sticking mandates that are going to be adding to the cost of insurance policies.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt. Mr. Vice Chair, we can have Perry Barnett and any entourage you want to bring with you.
It's a small entourage.
Mr. Vice Chair, why don't you come back up here where it's more comfortable? I'll give you the gavel for a moment. I'm going to run out as soon as they introduce themselves, and we'll run right back.
I've actually heard this story.
Mr. Chair, you helped write this story.
Ah, yes. There's that. I do have this kind of fantasy that somehow we can get these two bills together. Bill we can work out, but we'll talk about that later.
I'll take advantage of leaving right now.
Okay.
Please introduce yourself before you start, and I'll be right back.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kerry Barnett. I am here in my capacity as chair of the Oregon Health Policy Commission. Seated to my right is Gretchen Morley, who is the executive director of the Health Policy Commission.
You will introduce yourself when she talks at all.
Okay. In the interest of time, we're going to move through this pretty quickly. We're going to have some slides up in just a sec. Each of you should have a copy of the report in front of you. If you don't, you're about to. We really do appreciate the opportunity to be with you here today and to talk a little bit about some of the work that the Commission has been engaged in over the course of the last year or so. Do they have a copy of the slide deck?
They're just getting them.
Okay. Is the projector... You should have in front of you our slide deck, and I'll go ahead and refer to it until we get the slides up above. Very briefly, the first slide is titled Commission Overview, and the commission was established two sessions ago during the 2003 legislative session. It replaced what was then called the Oregon Health Council. You see listed there the membership, the 10 voting members, who I think represent a pretty good mix of skills and backgrounds and occupations, bringing a fair amount of expertise to the issue of health care policy. You'll also see that there are three legislators listed there. There are actually four legislators, legislative seats on the commission. We have one vacancy right now, and I draw your attention, of course, to Representative Greenlick's name. Representative Greenlick has been a very active and passionate contributor to all of our policy discussions, a very valuable member of the commission. which is, of course, why I said that he helped write the story. On the next slide, titled Commission Overview, you have our statutory purpose. And I'm not going to go through this in detail. Suffice it to say that that our statutory purpose is very broad. We provide advice to the Legislative Assembly and to the Governor on a broad range of health policy issues. The next slide, titled OHPC Mission, shows you the mission that we've developed. And if you look at the bullets, the thing that I want to stress here is that our focus is, once again, very broad. It is we do focus on access, but not solely access. We're also very much focused on increasing quality and the outcomes, the health outcomes, as well as controlling costs and promoting healthy lifestyles. On the next slide, you have commission principles for improving our system. When we set out as a commission, we identified some general principles, general approaches that we wanted to take in general to improve the healthcare system. And let me go through these very quickly. The first is simplification. Our healthcare system is extraordinarily complex, and unfortunately, that level of complexity does a lot to drive cost and the general unfriendliness of the system. So to the extent that we can strip out complexity, simplify the system, we think that those are important advancements. The second point there is invest in prevention. Very simply, there's a tremendous return on investment when you invest in prevention. If you prevent early on, you prevent enormous costs and unhappiness later on in the system. The third bullet is to manage chronic and catastrophic care. Why chronic and catastrophic care? Because that's where a lot of the costs show up. The fourth is align incentives. There are a lot of actors in our healthcare system, and each one is out there acting in a relatively rational way, given the incentives that that come into play for that individual. If we're going to rationalize the system in general, what we need to do is realign those incentives so that we're incenting the kind of behavior that, frankly, we find valuable from a system standpoint. And our perspective on that is that we want to make sure that decisions are being made in a cost-conscious and quality-focused way, as opposed to people having this notion that somebody else is paying the bill, so I can just go ahead and consume as much health care as I possibly want or need. The next bullet you see is to increase transparency. If the system is more transparent, there's a freer, easier flow of information, then it allows the market to work more effectively, and it allows the system to be simplified and easier to use by all the participants. Thank you, Gretchen. So next, as you can see, is to maintain a broad and strong safety net, recognizing that inevitably there will be some people who fall through the system. We need to make sure that we do, in fact, have a safety net in place that catches them. It's better to ration what's covered than to ration people. This is another way of saying we need to make conscious decisions as to what we're going to cover and who we're going to cover, and allocate those resources in the system in the most beneficial way for the system and the public at large. And then finally, focus on children. Why children? Because frankly, they're relatively inexpensive, and it's very important from a prevention standpoint to get kids into the system early on. About a year ago, the governor delivered to us an assignment, a charge, where he asked us to provide a roadmap for reform with some concrete steps to make advancements in the area of cost effectiveness and access over the near term. The focus, as you can see there, is on access for all Oregonians to affordable health care. And he also was very clear that we need to touch on the issue of sustainable financing. It's not enough to put together an access plan if you don't talk explicitly about how it might be funded. As we began to approach this reform effort, we quickly agreed on a few basic approaches. The first is that healthcare has to be a shared social responsibility. Employers, employees, government institutions, everybody needs to step up and bear some of that responsibility. We're focused on roughly a 5-year time horizon. That's what we think about when we think about the near term, the intermediate term. We wanted to acknowledge that, in fact, there are certain aspects of the current system that are working, and we want to build on them and support them, and those aspects of the current system that, frankly, don't work very well need to be overhauled. And then we also need to focus on the fact that access, cost, and quality are intricately intertwined. So you can't just focus on access, because often solving the access issue creates an increase in cost and a decrease in quality. You've got to have all three of those balls up in the air at the same time and try to solve for those variables at the same time. We need to focus on making rational coverage decisions, as I mentioned earlier. Give highest priority to prevention, care management, and catastrophic care, again, because that's where the greatest return on investment is. We needed to encourage delivery system integration and alignment of payment incentives, and then make sure that we're maximizing all available funding sources, particularly federal match dollars. And then we also wanted to acknowledge that there are a lot of other reform efforts pending out there, and our goal was to help coordinate with them as best we possibly can. Very quickly, I'm going to go through the recommendations that came out of the report, then go back through them in a little bit more detail. The first is cover kids. Start with universal coverage for children. I understand, of course, that there's been a lot of discussion in this building around that piece of legislation already. I won't spend more time on it. But the commission is very much in favor of that as a critical starting point.
And it is included in 3368.
That's my understanding. The second is an individual coverage requirement. If we require people to have auto insurance, doesn't it also make sense to require people to have health care coverage? We believe it's the starting point for that shared responsibility that we talked about. Now, of course, we recognize that that requiring individuals to have health coverage, it's not just enough to mandate that, because there are a lot of people who, frankly, can't afford to go out and purchase health coverage. And that leads to the third piece, which is expanded public coverage and then subsidies for those who can't otherwise afford coverage on their own. Number four is a health insurance exchange. Vice Chair Richardson has been discussing one aspect or one vision of the health insurance exchange. I'll talk a little bit more about it in a moment. And then finally, as I indicated earlier, it's not enough just to create a vision for access. You've got to talk about the hard nuts and bolts of how you finance this thing. Number six is delivery system reforms. This goes back to this notion that you can't simply talk about access. You've got to, at the same time, try to solve for the variables of quality, transparency, this notion of bringing value back into the insurance purchasing realm, technology, patient safety, and as I indicated earlier, to align incentives around provider reimbursement as well. The seventh aspect is support for community efforts to improve access and delivery. Gretchen will talk about this shortly. And then finally, there needs to be baked into any healthcare reform program rigorous implementation evaluation. How are we doing? Are we getting the kinds of results that we want to, so that there can be a process of continually improving the model as we go along? Okay, quickly. Let's go back to the individual coverage requirement and just put a little more flesh on that skeleton. It's a requirement that everybody obtain affordable health insurance. That often begs the question of, well, what do we consider to be acceptable health insurance? And frankly, we have decided that the best approach is a very broad definition of what a qualifying policy would be. If the insurance division of DCBS considers it to be an insurance policy, and if the individual identifies it as meeting his or her needs, from our perspective, that should be enough to meet the individual coverage requirement. There needs to be teeth to this requirement. if when you file your state income taxes, if you don't have proof of health insurance, you would lose your state deduction. So there needs to be an enforcement mechanism that goes along with this. We believe that an individual coverage requirement has benefits all around. The benefits for the uninsured, I think, are pretty self-evident. They bring the uninsured into the system and hopefully increases health outcomes for them. But there are significant benefits for the insured population, for society at large as well. And that benefit is that we would see a significant decrease in the cost shift that comes about when people are getting care in the often in the least cost-effective setting, and then those costs are being shifted over to the insured population. Public coverage and subsidies, in order to assist people to obtain that insurance, we would expand the Oregon Health Plan to 200% of the federal poverty level. Adults with employer-sponsored coverage would be required to use that employer-sponsored coverage. The effort there is to maximize federal match coming into the Oregon Health Plan. And then there would be sliding scale premium subsidies up to 300% of the federal poverty level. Health insurance exchange. Again, I'm going to go through this pretty quickly. We can talk in more detail a little bit later if you'd like. Our vision of the health insurance exchange is that it would be kind of a market organizer, the central forum for the purchase of health insurance. It would be available to individuals and small employers. One of the key benefits that it would offer would be the potential for pre-tax purchasing of private coverage for individuals, something which doesn't currently exist under the existing system. The exchange would also be the place where individuals would go to access the public subsidies that we talked about a moment ago. Hopefully, the exchange would drive value into the system by being a smart purchaser, by pooling together quite a number of lives and using the market power that it would inevitably have to drive efficiencies in system reforms. This is a schematic that shows how the exchange would work. It's also in the report. I think it's pretty self-evident. You can see at the bottom of the screen there that the premiums, this is where the premium subsidies would come to bear. I would emphasize that our notion of the exchange is that it would have to prove its own value. And it has to prove its own value out there in the marketplace. So if somebody believes that they can get the same or better value by purchasing their health insurance by going directly, in other words, by not going through the exchange, we think that's okay. There needs to be this self-regulating mechanism so that if it's providing value, people will come. If it's not providing value, people will go elsewhere.
And is this where an HSA model might actually fit in?
I think an HSA model would fit in very well. We would anticipate that the exchange would offer a broad range of policies, each one hopefully carefully designed to drive particular value into that particular offering. So it wouldn't simply open it up and say any carrier who wants to offer anything through the exchange can. I would hope that the exchange would get together and say these are the needs that we identify out there in the marketplace, and let's make sure that we're offering a good assortment of each of those product areas.
So if I may interrupt real quick, the seller or a
good... used to looking for you down here.
I know, I'm looking, sorry.
Go for it.
Self-insured groups would be an acceptable model, given...
I think that there would be opportunities for self-insured groups to play in the exchange model. I think that the way the exchange would work, most of the value that it would be driving, that it would be providing, would tend to be focused more in the small group and individual markets. If you think about your typical small employer out there, doesn't have a full-time HR professional to go out and sort through the marketplace and kind of figure out. I think most of the value that it would offer would be certainly greater on an individual and small group basis.
Okay. So a self-insured group could bypass exchange, is what you're saying.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's
correct. And then one other thing is this issue of mandates that you said that a plan could or a policy could meet the need of an individual where they are, which to me means that a young 20-year-old may not need to have everything that we have in our state. So you're looking at a little different model of in fact, not having mandates necessarily.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Maurer, our model doesn't necessarily require that there be a no-mandate offering. Check on that. To require that there be a no-mandate offering. I think that that would certainly be a possibility. When you start... there's a cautionary note here.
Yeah, it doesn't have mandates, does it? With fiat plans?
I believe it does.
Rocky's there.
Somebody here?
Rocky
go.
Rocky's back there. And
somebody wake Rocky up.
I believe it.
There he is.
You need to...
See what happens when you show up, Rocky?
A question, Mr. Chair.
Do fiat plans include mandates?
Yes, they do, for the group coverage and in the individual market. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool and the Family, the Office of Private Health Partnerships. The question is, does FIOP help purchase policies that have mandates? The answer to that is yes in the group market, subject to all group mandates. And in the individual market, yes, but a lot of the mandates don't apply to the individual market, i.e. mental health parity.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just make a quick comment on the issue of mandates. A caution about offering no mandate policies for certain populations side by side with mandate policies. What you don't want to have happen is for people who need the mandates to gravitate, to self-select over to this package of policies, and others who believe they don't need those services gravitate to the mandate-free policies. It creates a cycle of selection that I think in the end weakens the insurance pool.
One of the issues with the mandates is that you obviously spread risk over the entire pool when you have a mandate.
Right.
But on the other hand, you're putting people in a position where they're paying for something that they will never, ever use, never have the opportunity to use, ever.
Double.
Based on gender, age, health.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Maurer, I agree entirely. My point is simply that the way to get at the mandate issue is not necessarily to offer a side-by-side no mandate product, but instead to have some heightened discipline around the requiring of mandates across the market to begin with. I think you're absolutely right that there is a significant cost component that mandates tend to build in over time, and that concerns us significantly.
Okay. Now, if you had a mandate that says, I want, or it covers inpatient hospitalization, I mean, I think that's probably...
It's a coverage issue.
It's a cover. I mean...
Well, but the issue, I mean, there's a difference between the private market model and the social insurance model. And I think what was trying to be balanced here was that philosophy. It was trying to create social insurance with some individual room. But, I mean, I think of most mandates as not something that you will absolutely, positively never use. I think what you have in most mandates is except the gender-based ones, with most mandates is what you have is differentiating probabilities of using them at different times in your life, at different kind of sequences, and perhaps even at different genetic makeups. So that in the social insurance model, I'm sharing the risk across my lifetime and across other people in my cohort. So when I'm younger, I may end up paying more, but what I'm doing is contributing to the cost that will ultimately be borne over time by me, or at which the probability increases
over time. And I think there is this balance of a social insurance model and a private insurance model that we have to get to.
Now, I would agree with one exception, and that is there's an assumption that technology is static and that our knowledge is static, and that is not true. That technology is substantially better than it was 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, so there's also the assumption that there's no inflation. I mean, I paid something in 1968 for my health insurance. I would say in a lifetime I was contributing to what I was going to use last year, which I did. The fact is I paid for it in 1968 dollars, and based on 1968 technology, full knowing things were going to change in the next 40 years. So it's hard to deal with both inflation and the changes in the market. It's what's made social insurance so hard to... I mean, in the old days, in the 19th century, when we socialized the sick funds, things didn't change from generation to generation. There was basically no inflation over a lifetime, and there was basically no change in technology. It was much easier to... That's why we have actuaries, I think. Very pleased. Oh, yes, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, just to wrap up the exchange piece very quickly, we see this as a public-private hybrid structure. We think it's important that that it not be directly kind of an arm of state government, but it needs to have some accountability mechanisms built in to make sure that that it really is responsive to its basic purpose. We also believe that the funding for the exchange over time should be self-sustaining. The sources could include some sort of a transaction fee or membership fee, but it should not be dependent on some third-party source of funding. Again, the key is that it be designed and operated in a way that it drives real value that justifies its existence. Very quickly, relating to system financing, we have done some modeling around this. There are a lot of moving parts, a lot of variables. Preliminary estimates are $550 million a year for the expansion of OHP and for the sliding scale subsidies. This does include the kids coverage piece. I want to emphasize, of course, that's $550 million a year, $1.1 billion per biennium. We do talk in the report about different financing options. We believe that probably the most viable approach is some sort of payroll assessment. We also believe that it should be administered in a way that takes into account the fact that some employers are already paying a lot of money out to provide health care coverage to their employees. So there should be either some sort of either full or partial offset against the assessment based on dollars that are already being spent already being put into the system by employers. And again, there are some other funding options discussed in the report itself. I'm going to quickly hand it over to Gretchen. You want to come over here?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I guess, in knowing that we only have a few minutes left, I would be interested in knowing if you plan on testifying on Senate Bill 327 and the degree to which some of its recommendations in the amendments may connect to, or sorry, 329, may incorporate the work that's the recommendations you've made here.
For the record, my name is Gretchen Morley. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Policy Commission. Just to address Representative Cannon's questions, Representative Chair Greenlake, Representative Cannon, there hasn't at this point been a discussion or decision in terms of a Health Policy Commission testimony on 329, so I can't directly give you a response there at this point. But what I can tell you is that the current version of 329 includes a lot of the verbiage you would see in the Health Policy Commission report in terms of what the four subcommittees in that bill would be looking at. A lot of the elements, some that immediately come to mind are the health information technology pieces. They do mention an exchange in 329. There's several throughout that, and I think you'll see some parallels in it's actually some of the pieces I was just about to go over.
My plan is to go another 15 minutes, if you could take 8 to 10 minutes to finish, and then we've only had one person, Jamie Piles, sign up to testify. I'd like to give Jamie a few minutes at the end.
You're doing great, thank you.
Yes.
I understand. This would be like Haydn's 101st, right? People will be wandering off and will be left with just a violin in the middle of the stage. But that worked.
Representative Greenlick, members of the committee, I can actually go through this section fairly quickly, and you can use the slides. And what I'm going to be speaking from is actually section 5 and 6 of the report, and you also have a highlight section at the beginning of the report for quick reference. This slide actually is more just to kind of circle back to the reminder that the commission, while it set forward a structure that Carrie just went over that had a number of legislative provisions, many of them focused on access, while the exchange is both access and driving system quality improvement. There also are a number of recommendations in the commission report that get a delivery system reform. And this is just reminding the committee that the vision for a high-value affordable health care system had all of those, I guess, really the four-legged stool there of access, high-quality, efficient, evidence-based care and mechanisms for continuous system improvement. What you'll see, and actually one thing that's in Senate Bill 3368 is a creation of a model for a quality institute. That was a recommendation in the Health Policy Commission's report. Many of the other things that I'll mention here have actually House Bill 3368 were put underneath the Quality Institute, which I don't think that's a problem at all. It's just
it's in 329 as well.
Right. It was just inserted in 329 as well.
Is it board coordinating with yet?
With yet outside the exchange. Yes, there should be a comma there.
It coordinates with the exchange, yet it's outside the exchange.
Right.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Oh, I see. Coordinating with, yet outside. Yes. Okay,
yeah.
I got it.
No, missing a comma. The idea of the Quality Institute is creating a model that really brings all stakeholders to the table, that brings more quality information together and is disseminated in a way that's useful to all stakeholders of the system, and including individuals, and putting that information at the point of decision making. There's also a number of recommendations about improving value-based purchasing. I have been asked a number of times recently what we mean by value-based purchasing. I do like the definition that Reese Saylors gave the Senate committee last week, which was, you know, best bang for the buck, which essentially giving a whole range of strategies that purchasers can use to ensure that the best care is being provided in the best setting for the right cost. And so I won't go through the recommendations that are in the report. I would encourage you to look at that, and that's an area, obviously, of endless investment and of work that can be done. We have a number of recommendations on electronic health records, just some examples up there around leadership, coordination, privacy, security, interoperability, and potentially supporting pilot programs. Another recommendation was on improving collaboration and state leadership to improve healthcare safety, providing support to the Oregon Patient Safety Commission. Like I said, a number of these elements are mentioned under the Quality Institute in both Senate Bill 329 and House Bill 338. Right now, Chapter 6 in the report speaks to the input and the role that local communities can provide in reform. And I know right now two of the recommendations in the commission's report were around supporting a medical home model at this local level and supporting the local access collaboratives that are working around the state. And I know right now there's an effort underway to merge those bills and another similar one. And so we're pleased to see that work in progress.
I have one before us on Wednesday, right? A week from today?
I'm sorry.
The bill before us that merges those two, and safety net clinic support and some rural things.
You're talking about the workforce bill.
Yeah. I think we'll have it before us a week from today.
And the bill number is?
I think
the bill number doesn't have a bill yet. It's going to be an amendment to an existing bill that has a handy.
Okay.
I think it's so we're going to amend 3057, if I recall.
3057?
I believe.
Yeah. Well,
I'm not swearing to it, but I think that's what we use. Thank you.
You've seen the most recent draft.
Yes, sir.
And then the last bullet there is on realigning system incentives. Carrie spoke a little bit about that, and I'll return to that briefly just in mentioning what the commission is working on next. While we had a highlight box in the report on public health and health reform, and the commission is while we've been spending a ton of time over the last year focusing on health care reform, we continuously want to keep on the table that the issues of improving health and the environment in which people live matter as much as the health care system. And we recently released a report on strategies for addressing childhood obesity, and the commission looked for opportunities to work in that area. And we'll continue going forward. I think just some general issues about health reform and public health is putting a high priority on prevention services. Carrie mentioned that several times. And then if there's ways, I know some people may not use the term integration, but ways to coordinate public health and healthcare systems better. And I think a lot of the local collaborators provide an opportunity for combining. Really quick, evaluating reform. We can skip over that quickly because there is a component of evaluation in both House Bill 3368 and Senate Bill 329, so we're pleased to see that. And then just real quickly, what's next for the commission? The commission plans on kind of how we see it going to the next level down of reform, looking at how you very specifically, what kind of recommendations very specifically could help reform delivery system incentives. And I think that's the kind of thing that can fit within any reform system if there were something to pass this session. And just real quick, I would note this report is still in draft, and the website is here for public comment. We do encourage you sharing this website with whomever, any of your constituencies, because we're really encouraging input at this point.
That's great. Thank you very much. Any other questions for me? You sticking around for the excitement this evening? We're late for it.
Just a part of it.
Thank you very much, Gary. I really appreciate it. I think when we started talking about this in March, I said to a member for the audience as an ex officio without voting member of the commission, it seemed very unlikely that it would be possible for the commission to create something that could be put in as an actual legislative proposal to reform health care by the time the session started. It turned out Lori Freeman was able to take this draft report and turn it into a full-blown legislative proposal, which is 3368, and I think that means that you or we did a pretty remarkable job in coming to grips with some difficult issues in a far more successful way than other groups that have been working on this were able to do. So I really congratulate you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Now we'll see if there's any possibility we can actually move it. Jamie Piles, still here? Good.
Very good.
You'll just introduce yourself and please be very brief so we can go on downstairs and talk about health care reform.
Chairman Greenlake, members of the committee, my name is Jamie Piles. I'm a lifetime resident of Oregon. I live in Creswell. My issue is a slight deviation, but it does relate to some of the previous discussion we've just had. Over the past 9 years, I've served on the board of directors for a ministry called Samaritan Ministries International. It's based in Peoria, Illinois. And I'm here today representing that ministry as well as two other national ministries called Christian Care Ministry, based in Florida, and Christian Healthcare Ministries, which is based out of Ohio. Combined, our three ministries serve over 500 households and in excess of 1,000 individuals in Oregon. And nationally, we serve over 40,000 households and well in excess of 100,000 people nationally. Our ministries offer an alternative to health insurance whereby members voluntarily help with each other's medical bills. As such, no cost shifting occurs with our bills. We merely share financially, emotionally, and spiritually with one another in the ministries. We're not an insurance, as we don't take on any of the risk, and we do not have any reserve funds. Our concern, and the reason I'm here today, relates to the previous discussion that it seems apparent that you are strongly considering the possibility of individual mandates in the state of Oregon for individuals to be forced to buy health insurance, and we assume probably accurately that our ministry will not fit the criteria that you choose to identify for those mandates. What that means is that we would, in a sense, be our demise would be legislated, and I'm here to ask you to strongly consider the possibility of including some exemption language that we have provided and Representative Butler's office has produced and written, so that our members would not be placed in the quandary of what do we do if we have this mandate occur. We are an organization that has done what I consider to be the old-fashioned American ingenuity. We've found a way to take a problem and solve it ourselves without becoming a burden on the government or expecting the government to do so. We feel like we've kept ourselves out of those statistical categories that you guys are correctly trying to solve, meaning we don't go get health service and refuse to pay for it, and we don't refuse to take our children to the doctor because it's too expensive. We consider ourselves part of the solution as opposed to part of the problem, and so because of that, I would really like to ask you to strongly consider the possibility of finding a way to not legislating our demise and allow us to continue to do that. We're growing at about 2%, and a lot of people have not heard of the concept, but something I'm extremely pleased with, and so are most of our members. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, I really do have a question, and I raised it with your folks who came along. You have 1,000 people. What if 3 of your members end up using $2 million worth of health care or so in a year, which could easily happen in 1,000? I mean, I think I used that much in the last 2-3 years, something like that. So you've got then about $6,000 per person of your whole 1,000 people used up in one time period. Would each of them, I mean, is there any assurance that each of them would be willing to put up the $6,000, or if half of them didn't want to, the other half would be billed, would be able to put up $12,000 to pay for those expenses? Because that's what insurance is about.
Right. I understand that. Chairman Greenlick, I'm happy to answer that question the best I can. Over the 10 years that the ministry that I'm involved has been in an organization, we've never had bills go unpaid. Some of the testimony that you've heard today, I think, come into play here, and that is that one of the primary reasons people are members of our organization because at least 60% of them are below the median income in the state of Oregon, and so one of the first things that happens when we have a large medical bill is that we begin discussion with the provider, and a part of that discussion includes what can you do to help us out? This is what we have, and this is what you can do. And the testimony came forward today that people that are in the lower income brackets always find ways to make it happen. We have never left bills unsatisfied with providers, but there certainly have been some negotiations that were required. Your specific question was, are the people ready to step up to pay that much? Our bylaws call for a proration of the share amounts. There's a lot of details that you don't understand, and I don't presume that you'd want to take time right now to figure that out, but our bylaws call for a proration of the share amounts in the event that the medical needs for a given month or a group of months exceed the share amounts. And when that happens, the amount that's going to be provided to an individual doesn't necessarily reach the 97% that it normally would. And therefore, that's when all sorts of other opportunities with pleas to the membership at large for gifts in addition and negotiations take place. That your scenario hasn't happened to us, so I can't answer you.
If it doesn't happen.
I can't answer in a for certain way, but I can say that so far to this point, the providers have never gone unsatisfied in that situation. It's a very good question.
Why don't you hold any reserve funds at all?
The best answer I can give you to that question is that we don't want in any way to appear to look like an insurance company. because if we come under federal regulations for insurance companies, our costs would go to where we no longer can do what we do. And it becomes, we defeat our own purpose. So we feel like the very best way to do it is to avoid the temptation of bringing funds into house and manage that. And we have limited ourselves to simply payments between members. So we publish it and they go through there. And so I hope that answers your question best I can. We don't want to have a pool of money because it really defeats what we're trying to do in terms of community sharing and not appear to be insurance.
Yes. I want to make sure I understand how this works. You have 1,000 people, and they, based on their family size, agree that they're going to pay so much a month to help each other, and if they're in trouble with medical bills, they get help. Is that basically correct?
That's correct. Okay, we have way more than 1,000 people. I mean, our ministry has 12,000 households. We view ourselves as a national, not just a state. We have 12,000 in addition, in excess of 40,000 people in our ministry completely. We're dispersing about $2.7 million a month, but okay, so your model is correct.
It's a ministry. You say, you know what, I want to be a part of this, and I hope I don't need it, but I'm going to pay for any expenses myself. There's some kind of a threshold. And then I'm paying so much a month, and you will notify me of who I need to send it to because I'm going to help them. And then if there's a time when I'm in trouble, you'll notify others, and they will help me. And if I have a huge expense, then you might even go to the doctor or the facility and say, you know, I've got these people that are willing to help, but we can only help to the tune of $25,000. Would that offset? Are you willing to accept it? You, that's what you're talking about by negotiating. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That's a very moral system.
It's a very old system. I mean, the thing that intrigues me is if you look back at the so-called sick funds of Europe in the late 19th century, the Krankenkasse in Germany, for example, it was very much this form of self-help. A community, a occupation community, essentially banded together to help each other deal with.
I hope that we'll do what we can to protect that so it doesn't get crushed just by a title.
Heck no, we're going to nationalize it just like Bismarck didn't create a whole healthcare system.
As I've listened to your discussion today, it's definitely occurred to me that many of the principles that make what we do seem to work are definitely principles that you guys are trying to the personal responsibility, incentives for healthy living, incentives for not going to the doctor unless I really need to, and all those kinds of things are part of what we do, and that's why our costs, that's why our share amounts are a fraction of what people need to spend to go buy a private health insurance plan at this point.
Well, I hope you don't meet those bad risks some dark night. I tell you this, if we seriously think we're going to move one of these bills or a combination of these bills, we'll look very seriously at the amendments that you've...
I appreciate that a great deal. I trust that you do understand, and I know that you do, that an individual mandate in the state of Oregon is a huge infringement on personal freedoms, and I trust that you won't do that unless you've explored every other option completely, because it's a big deal, but it may be what you have to do.
Well, and it might be that we can include participation in this kind of an organization is meeting that mandate.
Thank you.
Because we are saying individual mandate, well, it's whatever health insurance you buy.
Uh-huh. I understand that.
Okay. Coming next.
Thank you very much for coming up. I do appreciate that. Any business? We're going to have a full committee meeting a week from Monday. Is that right?
Correct.
Just for future notice.
Correct.
We have to get all the...
We also have afternoon session. 4:30.
Yeah, and I've asked them to give us a little room so we can keep going, and they can call us if they need us. We have to get all our bills scheduled by the 20th, all our house bills, and finished by the 30th.
First chamber bill.
So the first chamber bill. So we're going to try and make sure we'll schedule everything, and I think we can do it. I think we don't have that many first chamber bills left that we haven't scheduled, but we'll keep an eye out.
Out of committee by the 30th or off the floor by the 30th?
Out of committee by the 30th.
Committee.
Yeah, well, they're going to want to move it off the floor as fast as they can because our bills are going to have to be out of the Senate committees.
By the end of May.
By the end of May. That's
And the Senate bills have to be out of our committees by the end of May.
No timeline.
You're going to get out of here by the 1st of July, I think. I close the public hearings on HB 3341 and on HB 3368, and I close the meeting of the Subcommittee on Healthcare Access of the House Committee on Healthcare.